Welcome into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Melody Wilkes, health coach as well. And, of course, we have a special guest via telephone this morning. But let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards and good morning to Melody Wilkes.
Hello.
Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Wade. Thanks for having me again.
Good to see y'all here on the show once again for another great program as far as You're the Cure. Of course, always brought to you by Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Be happy to help you out. You can also go to the website and catch up on past programs. If you've missed one, you can certainly do that from the website, veritasmedical.com. All right, so got a guest today on the show. What are we going to be talking about, Dr. Edwards?
Well, before I introduce our guest and jump into the topic, I want to start with just a reminder to all the listeners that the reason this show is named You're the Cure is because we believe our body is designed beautifully, perfectly. If you just support it and give it what it needs and avoid what it doesn't, it'll function like it's supposed to. With this new understanding, and a lot of these doctors around the country, integrative or functional medicine doctors, have this new understanding that we just need to support the body's innate ability to heal itself and function normally. You know, there's a lot of education that comes into play because this is a whole new way of thinking. You know, most people are used to just having a symptom or a disease diagnosed, take a pill, and, you know, the doctor is well educated and knows everything. And what I've learned in the past 5 years since understanding there was more to the story than what I learned in medical school, my passion now is to teach, which is what I do when I go give lectures all around these different communities, the radio show here. And a big part of what I feel obligated to do is give informed consent. And that's kind of how I start a lot of my lectures these days, is the definition of informed consent, which I'll just read it right now. This is from just the online dictionary. Informed consent is a permission granted in the knowledge of the possible consequences, typically that which is given by a patient to a doctor for treatment with full knowledge of the possible risk and benefits. So a lot of listeners are probably familiar with this. If you're, you know, about to have some sort of procedure done on you, the doctor's going to explain, here's all the potential bad things that could happen, and here's all the potential good things that we're hoping will happen. And you weigh that risk and benefit, and then you sign the form that gives the doctor permission to perform this procedure on you, with the full knowledge that you were just informed with all the potential risk and all the potential benefit, and then you decide. It's your body, it's your health, it's your decision. But you got to have all the facts. You got to have the information. You've got to be informed. That's the name of this consent, informed consent. So I want everyone to keep that in mind. Informed consent is something really, unfortunately, a patient kind of has to push for and seek out because doctors aren't fully informed themselves. Today's topic, I'm just going to go ahead and say, is vaccines. Now, I don't want people running off and turning their radio off or getting high blood pressure over this. It's such an emotional, hot topic, and I just want to say right now, let's just diffuse the emotion and let's talk facts. And that's what we're going to try to do today, is bring some facts to the table so people can make an informed consent. I've said before on the show, you know, the thought that you could sort of inoculate the body with a little bit of a germ, you know, like the original vaccine, the original inoculation, cowpox, take a little pus from a cowpox pustule on a patient and inoculate it into an open wound of another patient, and you hope that that little introduction of part of that foreign germ will trigger your immune system to ramp up some good antibodies to that germ so that when you get full exposure, you'll be ready for it. You'll be able to fight that germ and successfully overcome that illness. You know, that whole thought process, I don't think anybody would disagree with. That sounds great. If we could get a little bit of this in us, and that would prime the pump and get our immune system pumped up, ready to go and fight when the big bug really does come, that's a great thought process. Unfortunately, where we've come now is way beyond that. There's a lot more than just a little bit of that germ in a vaccine. There's lots of different additives. And we would hope that there are a lot of studies that would prove that this thought process, this theory, really worked well, and that the risk and benefits were such that it was way more benefit than risk. Unfortunately, those studies aren't really there. patients don't realize that. I didn't realize that. I'll tell you, in med school, what I learned was about vaccines. They printed out the CDC's recommended vaccine schedule. The newborn gets a hepatitis shot, you know, day of life, one or two, and then at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and just the whole schedule's laid out, and we were asked to memorize the schedule and be sure we implemented that schedule in our clinics. I never read a vaccine package insert. I never was informed on really the history of the vaccine program or the risk and benefit and all this stuff you would want to be educated in. I wasn't. So once I started my integrative practice 5 years ago, I had mothers come to me, and I'm very pro-vaccine at this point. I'd vaccinate all my children fully. But I had these moms come to me with questions such as, why is the safe limit of aluminum per the EPA 50 micrograms or, according to the FDA, 17 micrograms, but there's 250 micrograms in the hepatitis shot that my baby gets on the first day of life? I couldn't answer that question. And they had a number of other questions. Why is there aborted fetal cell line tissue potentially in some of these vaccines? Why is there retroviruses and all these different potential other things, other ingredients? I couldn't answer that. But what really got me was these three different moms that came in and said, hey, I was pro-vaccine, took my kiddos in, 18-month shots, got the shots. The next day had a high fever. The baby had a high fever and started regressing in their milestones. I mean, these were just honest, simple, loving, caring mothers. They're not fanatical. They're not anti-vax. They're not any label that people try to label folks with. They were just good old West Texas normal folks. And these are mamas who noticed something happened with their baby associated with a vaccine, in their opinion. And they were asked to leave the practice of their pediatrician by questioning that. That's how they ended up in my office. So it was a number of these moms who got me to start looking at this thing and researching and diving into some stuff to try to get to the truth. And unfortunately, what I found was the safety studies aren't there, and there's a whole lot of questions that are unanswered. Now, let me just state clearly, we know for a fact, I mean, we don't need to debate this part. It's just factual that vaccines can injure. That's non-debatable. The vaccine compensation program, which I didn't even know existed. Again, I'm a highly trained medical doctor. I came out of medical school, didn't even know the U.S. government had a vaccine injury compensation program that has paid out $3.7 billion since its inception. So, and they paid that out because the vaccines injured the person, and it went to this court, and the court awarded a compensation to the tune of $3.7 billion so far. So we know that this happened. So now let's move beyond that. Let's get to the point of, okay, can we figure out who is at the most risk? You know, a lot of people get vaccinations and don't appear to have any problems. Some people do get vaccinations, appear to have problems, and only appear. The vaccine court's awarded a lot of money. So let's move beyond that. We know it can injure. Let's figure out who's at highest risk, and what can we do to mitigate the risk? That's where we should be focusing all our questions, all our effort, all our emotion, all our research dollars, and all that. And that's why we've got our guest today, because I feel like what he's done is help bring those two questions to the forefront. Who's at higher risk, and is there something that can be done to lessen or reduce that risk? So today, I'm very happy to introduce, and I'm sorry for that long spiel because we're wasting time, that Dr. Brian Hooker could be speaking, but I wanted to lay that groundwork there to try to engage the listeners and to not get into their emotional stance, and just really let's have a conversation about how we can mitigate this risk that we know there is. So Dr. Brian Hooker, PhD, Associate Professor of Biology at Simpson University in Redding, California. He specializes in chemistry and biology coursework. He graduated with a Bachelor of Science in 1985, a degree in chemical engineering. I'm from California State Polytechnic Institute, also a Master of Science degree in 1988, and his doctorate in 1990, both in biochemical engineering from Washington State University. Dr. Brian Hooker has many accomplishments to his credit, including a co-inventor for five patents, recipient of a Battier Entrepreneur Award in 2001, a Federal Laboratory Consortium Recognition Award in 1999 for his work on reactive transport in three dimensions. The breadth of Dr. Hooker's 60 different science and engineering papers have been published in internationally recognized peer-reviewed journals. So, scientist, I guess is how you can sum up Dr. Brian Hooker, but also Dr. Hooker's a dad of a son who has autism. So, and Dr. Hooker has a lot of information to share with us. And Dr. Hooker, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. I know you're out in California and it's early out there, so we appreciate you being on the show today.
No problem. My pleasure, Dr. Edwards. It's great to be on your show. I am really excited to share my story and also applaud you for the information and, you know, your conclusions in terms of the lack of information that is out there regarding vaccines, especially infant and maternal vaccines.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Dr. Hooker, I'd like you just to start, if you would, by kind of sharing your personal story and kind of where that's led you to the point today, which I'll just go ahead and let the listeners know. Dr. Hooker is pretty much one of the primary focuses of the documentary Vaxxed, which is a film about a cover-up at the CDC, and Dr. Hooker's right in the middle of all that. So we'll get to that part, but I want him to really paint the picture of what led up to that. So Dr. Hooker, just kind of share your testimony, your story, if you would.
Okay. My son, Stephen, is 20 years old. He has a profound developmental disability. He is nonverbal. And it turns out that what happened with him was he was injured specifically by his vaccines that he received when he was 15 months old. Just to give you some background and context, I grew up in a public health family. My mother is a public health nurse, and she was in charge of distributing and overseeing the vaccination program for one of the large counties in Southern California. And so my perspective was that vaccines were the best thing since sliced bread. And I remember looking at the vaccination schedule and looking even at the expanded vaccine schedule because my son was vaccinated in 1999 and 1998. And he received a lot more vaccines than I ever received as a child. But I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be so great. He never has to go through chickenpox. He never has to get the measles. And I was very excited, and he was vaccinated on time. But we noticed that he was tracking a little slow. He was making his milestones. He was starting to speak. He had language. He was interacting with us. And then at his 15-month well-baby appointment, he received three vaccines, all while having an active ear infection. He received the DTaP vaccine, the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, and the oral polio vaccine. He also had an active ear infection. And at the time, I didn't know that was contraindicated. I didn't know that you weren't supposed to vaccinate a sick child. And the nurse practitioner who vaccinated him said, oh, it's not a problem. It's no big deal. In fact, we had an appointment that same day with the ear, nose, throat doctor who was going to look at him as a potential candidate for ear tubes. And so we knew that he had an infection, but he was vaccinated anyway. It turns out that he ran a low-grade fever for a very, very long time. After about 2 weeks, that fever spiked at 102, 103, and he was very, very sick baby. And from that point on, he lost all of his language. He lost all eye contact. He lost everything that he had, all the gains, any type of interaction that he had with my wife and I was just absolutely gone. And so much so that by the time he was 18 months old and he went back in to his practitioner, he was diagnosed with full-blown autism, which was actually very, very early for a child like that to get a diagnosis. And we had that diagnosis affirmed in a special ed preschool where he started when he was about the same month that he was diagnosed with autism. And he had multiple things going on. His had chronic diarrhea, had multiple ear infections. He was just, from that point on, not only was it autism, but it was also severe, just, you know, picking up any type of infection. He seemed like he was immunocompromised, which, in fact, we found out later on that he is immunocompromised. He was diagnosed with a mitochondrial dysfunction as well. And it wasn't until my son was 2 years old that we had even thought to suspect vaccines. We found an integrative physician in our community. We lived in Eastern Washington at the time, and that integrative physician proceeded to tell me all about mercury in vaccines and aluminum in vaccines and the issues around receiving multiple antigens within a live virus antigens within a vaccine. And this whole world opened up that I never, ever knew of. And we suspected that he was mercury toxic. And when we did a hair metals analysis, it showed that we were doing a very, very, very mild intervention to get mercury out of his system. And mercury was pouring out of his hair. Mercury was pouring out of his urine and feces. And I didn't even know at that, it was, I had this recollection, and I remember getting the first hair analysis where we saw this mercury coming out, and I just crumpled into a ball in our bathroom and just cried and cried and cried. I could not believe that this would actually happen to my wonderful child, and I could not believe the lie that I had been told regarding vaccines and regarding the safety and efficacy. Who would ever put mercury into a tiny baby? It just made absolutely no sense to me. And so as a scientist, I was very, very concerned, and I started to monitor and look at the research coming out of the CDC because I wanted to know more. And the Centers for Disease Control is really the bastion of vaccine safety, especially for infant and maternal vaccine safety in the United States. They were the ones that were supposed to be the watchdog. And so I started to watch that agency very, very close because the question of vaccines and autism was coming up over and over and over again. And that really started my journey in terms of looking more heavily into this issue and using my scientific background to understand really the lack of good science and even the fraudulent science that was coming out of the CDC.
Yeah. That kind of reminds me of Robert F. Kennedy. I think it was last year, held a press conference at the press Washington Press Club. And the press conference was all about this $100,000 reward he was offering for any scientist who could produce a good study that showed safety of vaccines and mercury, et cetera. And on the table next to him at the press conference was this huge stack of papers and one pile, and then a medium stack and another pile, and then the last pile was empty. And that last pile was the number of studies produced that showed that the current vaccine schedule was safe. And that's one of the biggest alarming red flags to me, is it's the studies just aren't there. So as you were monitoring that, looking for that, looking at vaccine studies coming out of the CDC, what did you see? What did you find? Besides maybe there wasn't a whole lot.
Well, I found that the science that was being done by the CDC was completely suspect, and that the CDC was fraught with institutional and even financial conflicts of interest. The CDC is in charge of vaccination uptake. They promote vaccines very, very heavily. In fact, they spend about $500 million every year just promoting vaccines. Also, in contrast, in looking at vaccine safety, whether this vaccine schedule is safe for children or not, they were receiving about $20 million. So they were receiving just a mere fraction of the amount of money that they were using to advertise vaccines, to push vaccines, to actually determine whether they were safe and effective. And as a scientist back in 2001 until 2003, I was calling CDC scientists directly on the phone, trying to find the status of different studies that they were doing. They did a big study on mercury in vaccines called the Verstraten study, and they were producing different iterations of this study. And with each iteration of the study, it became very, very clear that they were not out for the truth. that they were looking to hide what appeared to be a very, very strong, statistically significant relationship between neurodevelopmental disorders like autism and mercury in vaccines. And back at that point, this was the early 2000s, the vaccination schedule was loaded with mercury, and the mercury in the vaccines is a huge issue, but the thing that stood out was the depth to which they went in order to hide any type of relationship. They were basically an agency out to indemnify vaccines. And when I started to point this out around 2003 and 2004, directly to CDC scientists and really called them on the carpet, I received a letter from a CDC attorney, which was essentially a cease and desist letter to stop talking, to stop emailing, stop contacting CDC scientists. What they did, which was very, very dubious, was they found out that I was participating in the compensation program to get my son compensated from the injuries that he was receiving from vaccines. And the letter said that, in effect, I was suing the CDC, and therefore, because I was suing the CDC, then I could no longer contact them. And it was preposterous. I remember I showed the letter to my own attorney, and he laughed at it, and he produced a letter back to the CDC saying that Dr. Brian Hooker, as a private citizen, has the right to contact any scientist in any federal agency, and in fact that the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was suing no one, and it was a no-fault program. And the CDC then agreed and said at that point, look, you know, Dr. Hooker can contact any CDC scientist, but they're not going to respond back to him. So the only thing that I could do at that particular point in time was to start to submit what are called Freedom of Information Act requests, where I could get the behind-the-scenes emails, the correspondences, the reports, the memos. And I started then in 2004 to exercise that particular avenue and submitted FOIA requests. And the fraud and the duplicitousness of the entire vaccination program and the Vaccine Safety Office at the CDC that really poured out in droves. I was receiving thousands and thousands of pages of documents to showing financial relationships between the CDC and other entities that they had paid off to show that vaccines were safe and effective. I saw instances with a group of researchers in Denmark where they actually were directed by CDC officials to omit data that showed a relationship between vaccines and autism. And it wasn't that they were doing bad science. It was that they were doing fraudulent science. And, you know, I've done this ever since. I still submit Freedom of Information Act requests to the CDC. At last count, I've submitted about 120 requests and received over a quarter of a million pages of documents. And the fraud continues. It's standard operating procedure. Since I started investigating the CDC in 2001, it's now 2018. And this is a propaganda machine and a very, very conflicted, what we would call an agency that had been captured by the pharmaceutical industry, and it continues to this day.
Okay, so I want to summarize a little. What you're saying is you got were able to obtain some data, which you had to get through a Freedom of Information Act, to get the raw data of these studies. What you saw was that the CDC's own studies showed some correlation with these different vaccines and neurodevelopmental delay, such as autism. But that data was either not published or the data was altered. Statistical gymnastics were performed to alter the significance of the data. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. The CDC will what they'll do, and when I was ultimately contacted by a whistleblower, and we'll talk about that in a minute, that was the subject of the movie Vaxxed, the whistleblower told me, he said, you've got to understand, when the CDC scientists see a relationship that would harm the vaccination program that would show that there was a problem with a vaccine. They get a bunch of scientists in a room and they work on the statistics. They work over the statistics and they do, like you said, statistical gymnastics in order to make that relationship go away. If they can't make that relationship go away, then they just simply do not report that effect and act as if it never existed.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about this on the show before, specifically with Tamiflu. There's a thing called publication bias. That when a study's done, if the results aren't what the researcher wants or the person funding the research wants, then they simply don't publish it, put it in the filing cabinet, and no one ever sees it. And there's that old saying, statistics don't lie, but statisticians do. And I think that's very appropriate here, because as you got the actual statistics, you got the raw data, you were able to see that relationship and basically figure out, wow, the stats don't lie, but the statisticians do. It's the bottom of the hour already, so we've got to take a break. But when we come back, we'll get into a little more detail on the whistleblower and exactly, you know, how that all panned out, and then where we are today with this whole issue and what the hope is for the future. So stick with us. We'll be right back from the break. All right. We are back with You're the Cure. We've got Dr. Brian Hooker on with us today. And I want to reiterate that what I said at the top of the show is we're moving beyond the debate of can vaccines injure people? Of course they can. It's in the package insert. There's a vaccine compensation program that compensates injured folks. So we know it can. So now we're moving to, okay, who's at highest risk? Is there a way to mitigate it? And as Dr. Hooker, even in his own personal story, we can see with his son at 15 months old had an ear infection. So there's one thing right there, right out of the bat, that you don't vaccinate kids that are sick. That needs to be stressed more to doctors, to nurse practs, to parents, to nurses, to everybody. We should just know that. And if any kiddo is sick, we're just skip the vaccine. So that's one way to mitigate the risk some. But it turns out there's other ways too. And there was a study done in Atlanta, Georgia, on kiddos. I believe it was African-American kids. And it seemed to indicate some other things we could potentially do to mitigate risk, such as delaying vaccines for a month or two or three or five might reduce the risk, or certain ethnicities might be at more risk. There's a lot of potential questions we could pose as researchers and then go figure out and try to minimize this risk. So I want to talk about that Atlanta study a little more, but we can't do that without talking about the whistleblower that Dr. Hooker mentioned at the CDC. So Dr. Hooker was watching the CDC, watching their data and their papers that were being published. He was contacting them to try to get the raw data. He was using Freedom of Information Act to try to get more data. So Dr. Hooker, take it from there with specifically when and how and why did the whole whistleblower thing with the scientists at the CDC come about.
Great. Well, just to go back to something that I had mentioned earlier, I was in touch with CDC scientists back in the early 2000s, and one of the primary scientists that I was my point of contact was one Dr. William Thompson. And Dr. Thompson at that point was very dismissive of my concerns. He was very, seemed even arrogant on the phone regarding some of the concerns. And at one point, said, well, my daughter got all the same vaccines as your son, and she's just fine. And I was shocked. I could not believe an epidemiologist would say something like that to me. And I said something like, well, I guess your daughter is just genetically superior than mine compared to my son. And he backpedaled and said, no, that's not what I meant. But anyhow, fast forward to 2013, I get a phone call on my cell phone. And it was a 404 area code, and I knew that was Atlanta, and I knew that it was probably the CDC. And over the time period, actually back in 2005, 2006, I had received some anonymous harassing phone calls from the CDC for my work and for what I was trying to expose. And so I didn't pick up. I didn't want to experience that again. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just let it go to voicemail. And the person who called did not leave a voicemail, and my curiosity, though, got the best of me, so I ended up calling that number back and got the voicemail for the gentleman who called, and lo and behold, it was Bill Thompson. And so here he is. He's calling me in 2013, and so we exchanged
emails. This is like 10 years later?
Yes, this is 10 years later.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and then we ended up exchanging emails, and we finally did talk on the phone, and he was a completely different person. He was apologetic. One of the first things he did was he asked about my son, how my son was doing. He knew that my son had been injured by infant vaccines and was autistic, and all of a sudden, Dr. Thompson started sharing with me ways that I could get inside data and actually encouraging me to reanalyze data regarding different studies that the CDC had done, different studies that the CDC was working on, and he was giving me the inside track on how I could get more data, more raw data from the CDC so I could repeat and affirm the analyses that they were doing or dispute what they were doing. And so I did that. I very, very quickly, our first phone conversation was in November of 2013, and I started to request data from different studies. And one of the first studies that he actually entreated me to look at was what was called the Metropolitan Atlanta Developmental Disabilities study that included a large sampling of children that had autism as well as non-autistic control children that were situated in metropolitan Atlanta. And so he actually coached me on how to get the data, and then he coached me on how to do the study while I was on the outside of the CDC, while he was talking to me very, very privately. And over that period of time, we probably talked on the phone, I'd say 40 times.
Wow.
And not only was he coaching me on the study, but he was telling me about this culture of corruption and a culture that really, if one of the CDC scientists like himself fell out of the party line, one of the CDC scientists started to dispute vaccine safety and started to dispute these dubious methods that they used really to indemnify vaccines, then they would be suspended, they would be subject to personnel actions, they would be scrutinized. In some cases, if an employee disputed the party line, they would be told that they had a mental health problem and be referred to counseling. And so, you know, this sort of culture of you state the party line, vaccines are safe and effective no matter what, no matter what the data says, started to unfold before my eyes. And over these phone conversations, I ended up, towards the end of the period that we were talking, I ended up recording about four of them. I had four long phone conversations with them, and I had to set up sort of a scenario where I could record them. I live in the state of California where it's illegal to record somebody without their consent. But I live in near Oregon, and Oregon is a state where you can do that. And so I would take my car and I'd drive up to Oregon, and I recorded these phone conversations without him knowing, and these four long phone conversations that ended up being released ultimately and also part of the movie Vaxxed.
Wow. So what do you think in those 10 years from when it sounded like he was almost belittling you and you know, questioning the whole vaccine safety thing, and to him calling you, asking how your son's doing, and then basically telling you, here's how you need to go about unraveling the truth. I mean, have you all been able to talk about that, or it would just be conjecture, I guess, if we're guessing, but that's a dramatic change in stance on Dr. William Thompson's part.
Yes, yes. He, during that 10-year time period, he had actually gone to the highest level of the CDC to warn them about the problem with the Metropolitan Atlanta study, a study that showed that African-American children were at higher risk for autism if they received the MMR vaccine on time versus those children that did not receive their first MMR vaccine until they were 3 years of age or older. And he tried to warn his supervisor, his supervisor's supervisor, and he just went up the management chain until he wrote an email directly to the director of the CDC, Dr. Julie Gerberding at the time. And what happened, he was there was a very, very important meeting regarding vaccines and autism. It was in what's called the Institute of Medicine, and this was in 2004. He was to present that information, and he was going to, because of his ethics and because of his moral character, he was going to present the truth. And when he told that to Dr. Gerberding, not only was he yanked from the schedule of the Institute of Medicine meeting on vaccines and autism, he was replaced with a supervisor, Dr. Frank DiStefano, who ended up lying and said that there was no cause of harm of the MMR vaccine, that there was no harm in getting the MMR vaccine on time, which is preposterous. It was something that was completely diametrically opposed to their data. And not only was Dr. Thompson taken from that meeting and was not allowed to present at that meeting, he was put on administrative leave of absence, and he was almost fired because he dared tell the truth. And so this impacted him in a huge way. He was reprimanded over that 10-year time period twice and had official letters of reprimand in his personnel file because he dared tell the truth. And so I think that the culture of corruption in the CDC really bit him. And then over this period of time, suddenly in 2013, he was prompted to call me.
Mm. Wow. So he has a conscience, really, is what it boils down to. So what you're saying, this one particular study in Atlanta, they looked at the data, and what they saw was African-American boys that were receiving MMR on schedule, on time, that didn't miss a shot or get delayed for some reason, they had an increased risk. And was it, I don't remember if you said this or if I read this, a 300% increased risk of autism?
It turns out that when I reanalyzed the data, African-American boys receiving the MMR on time, that's anywhere between 0 and 18 months of age, had about a 260% increased risk of having autism versus those that waited and got their MMR after 3 years of age.
Wow.
And that discounted, that didn't include the children that didn't receive the MMR at all. And you would presume that if the comparison was to children that didn't receive the MMR at all, the risk would even be higher than 260%.
Wow. So that data is what William Thompson knew in 2004 and was going to present and was then not allowed to present.
That is correct.
Imagine if that data was presented. We could have immediately, at least even just in that subgroup of African-American kids, let's push your MMR off a little ways. You know, let's delay it a little bit. How many kids could have been spared? And how much more research could have been done to figure out what other groups or whatever, what's the best time frame or schedule, et cetera, et cetera. But anyways, so he wasn't allowed to present. But then he reached out to you 10 years later, gave you this information on here's what you need to ask for and how you need to analyze it. You reanalyzed it and had these recorded phone calls, and then you were basically ready to go public with it, correct?
That is correct. In fact, I reanalyzed the data, developed my own peer-reviewed publication, published the results in a journal called Translational Neurodegeneration, and the results were published, and they were made public in July of 2014. And I was very, very proud of that paper, and it showed a strong statistically significant effect, and it nailed down directly to African-American males in this group that they studied in metropolitan Atlanta. And then the whistleblower story actually went forward. I was working with Dr. Andy Wakefield at the time, and so we decided to go forward and publicize the fact that there was a whistleblower and that it was Dr. William Thompson around the end of August 2014, and all hell broke loose. Everything, the CDC was on high alert. It was very, very strenuous time. I had, you know, was receiving calls to get interviewed by different news outlets, ABC News, CNN, Fox. You know, there were, but it was very, very interesting because at the same point in time, the journal where I published that research contacted me and they wanted to retract my paper. They wanted to, the paper that I published with this very, very important information. And it turns out, and I kind of put two and two together, and this is a bit of conjecture, but it turns out that somebody from the CDC, in fact, it could have been the director at the CDC who was, according to Thompson, trying to find out as much about me as possible. The director's name at the time was Thomas Frieden. And so Frieden was asking Thompson, who's Brian Hooker and why have you been in touch with him? And then meanwhile, it appears somebody, you know, when the whistleblower story broke, contacted the journal and came up with a very, very phony story about a conflict of interest that I supposedly did not report. And so they took the paper down from their website because of this phony conflict of interest. And then under very, very dubious circumstances, the paper then was retracted in October 2014. Even though it's scientifically solid, I never really received any substantial reason why they would want to retract my paper. I stand by the science to this day. But it's very, very interesting because when you try to publish honest vaccine safety science, this is just what happens.
Yeah, it's really, really sad and unfortunate. You know, what shocked me most about that in the documentary Vaxxed was the fact that at the CDC, they, according to William Thompson, had these meetings that gathered these scientists together with all this data from this Atlanta study, and were told, no, now take it back to your desk and rework the data. Make this go away. Make this 260% increased risk go away. And they had a few meetings back and forth, and nobody could make it go away. So then they said, okay, bring me all the data, and we're going to throw it away, basically. Throw it in the trash can, and nobody talk about it. I mean, it's shocking, absolutely shocking.
They scheduled a meeting, and they rolled in. I believe the meeting was on a Saturday, and they scheduled a meeting, and some of the top CDC officials were there. In fact, the meeting was ordered by one Dr. Colleen Boyle, who is now in charge of all their whole center on birth defects and developmental disabilities, including autism. She ordered that meeting. She was not present at that meeting, but she ordered that meeting in which the data were destroyed.
But William Thompson kept some and ended up, you were able to get some of that data and bring all this to public. So that is quite the journey, quite a lot of stress and a lot of sleepless nights, I'm sure, not even to mention your son with autism through all this. So you've just been through so much. I think we all owe you a lot. And we just have a few minutes left, and there's so much more we could talk about, but I want to just pose this because I know some listeners are probably wondering. I mean, we've identified that obviously sick babies shouldn't be vaccinated. African-Americans on time, males for sure, need. It sounds like based off this one study at least, we need to delay. Do you have an opinion or is there any more science that's coming out that has come out since then or just your own personal thought and opinion on who's at highest risk? Is there a better way or safer way besides, do we just say no to all vaccines? Is there a way to delay it? Do you have any input or any take or advice just from your personal standpoint, or is there any data that would suggest something?
Well, from my personal standpoint and also from the data that I've seen come out of the CDC, also some very good studies that have come out recently, I think that participating in the vaccination program as is a huge risk. I mean, there has been no true vaccinated versus unvaccinated child study to look at health outcomes, to look at chronic diseases like autism, ADHD, asthma, Tourette syndrome, things like that, that are on the rise. And so, you know, I believe that you're putting yourself at risk if you follow this current vaccination schedule, and if you are taking vaccines that are unstudied or understudied, then you're participating in this really grand medical experiment. And where you're being told by your practitioner a lot of times that, oh, there is no risk, or the risk is one in a million. And, you know, when you come to my house, the risk is not one in a million.
Yeah.
The risk is much, much higher than that. And if I had known any of that, specifically regarding my own child and my own child's genetic makeup, which we understand a lot more, we would have never gotten him vaccinated.
Yeah.
And I do believe that the technology is there that we can target the vulnerable child, and we can look at vulnerable children in society that should never receive a vaccine. Now, I'm not endorsing that anybody follow the vaccination program. I think that for well babies, for babies that vaccinations seem to be well tolerated, I think that there are some issues there just because of the lack of research studies, the lack of safety studies that have been on vaccines. But the thing that has troubled me is that we could screen vulnerable children. We could identify vulnerable children even on their day of birth, and we could say this child should not be vaccinated, and we could avoid many, many disabilities by doing that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Unfortunately, it appears to me that money, the love of money, profits, maybe might be taking a more important role than the safety and health of our children. I remind our listeners, we talk about this all the time, we have the sickest kids in the world just about. I mean, 50% of the kids now have a chronic disease. Not only are autism, neurodevelopmental delay diagnoses skyrocketing, the incidence of these skyrocketing, but different autoimmune issues and the whole allergy, asthma, eczema stuff. So there's something wrong with American children. I'm not going to blame it all on the current vaccine schedule program, but obviously there's a whole lot of questions that aren't answered, and we need to be doing a whole lot more. We had someone text in a question real quick in the last 2 minutes. Do you have any thoughts on the flu vaccine? You know, that's separate from the infant vaccine program, but as far as data, we talk about the Cochrane Review Board analyzing data over the last 30 years and really coming back with, it's not really that beneficial. But you have any thoughts on that? We're kind of getting out of flu season now, but what's your take there?
I do. One of the things that I'm very, very concerned about is if you look at the number, the vaccines that still have mercury in them, it's the flu shot. And not all flu shots contain mercury, but if you do get a flu shot that has a multi-dose vial, then the adult formulation and the child formulation and the maternal formulation, the one that is given to pregnant women, can contain as many as 25 micrograms of mercury, which would be tolerable. In order to tolerate that by the EPA, FDA guidelines, you'd have to weigh about 500 pounds. Okay, so nobody, if you're, so it's right out of the gate. I mean, you've got the mercury issue with the flu shot. And even beyond that, there are now studies regarding women who have gotten flu shot in pregnancy having greater risk. Even the CDC is saying that there's a greater risk of having a miscarriage, especially if you're in the early portion of your pregnancy. And also, there's a greater risk in the first trimester of pregnancy that you would have a child that has ASD. I published a letter to the editor in the journal JAMA Pediatrics, and these are things that are in the open literature. They're proven, and so I'm very, very concerned because a lot of OBGYNs are pushing the flu shot.
Yeah.
They are pushing the flu shot, and it causes inflammation. It causes neuroinflammation in the developing unborn fetus, and that is causing problems.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, doctors are so busy, and this is a really lame excuse, but they are so busy, and they're kind of just given some institutional guidelines to follow, and they don't have time to go dig through the literature and find this stuff and read it, and they just assume that who's ever in charge of these institutional committees and advisory boards are looking out for everybody's best interest. So they're
right.
They just come out with the company line of, the flu shot or whatever, the vaccine, infant vaccine schedule is safe, effective, and it's just not true. That it hadn't been proven out. And that's all we're really asking here is let's do some good research, some good science, and replicate it, and then we can come up with a good, effective, safe program, and because safe and effective has not been proven, unfortunately. Well, we are about out of time. Well, we are out of time. So, Dr. Hooker, the hour flew by, but we sure appreciate you. I want to say thank you again. I know, you know, personally going against the grain is hard to do. And I can't really imagine what you've had to go through, not only raising your son with this disability induced by vaccines, but also just I'm sure your reputation has been tarnished all over the internet and other places, and just sure. You spending countless hours and effort and so much emotion and strain on the family and on you personally. But I think it's a testament to who you are and your moral character and ethics, and I think you'll go down in history as a great man who tried to advance the cause of science and medicine. And so thank you for all you do. I don't think you have a book or do you have a website? Or if people want to just learn more, that they're shocked by all this is all new to them, where can they go learn more from you or from – do they watch Vaxxed or what do you recommend?
I would recommend that I am science advisor for an organization called Focus for Health. Focus for Health has wonderful articles, not just on the vaccine issue, but on other issues regarding wellness. And it's focusforhealth.org.
Okay.
And that's a great place to go. Yes, see the movie Vaxxed. I think that you can still get it on Amazon. I'm not absolutely sure. You can go to vaxthemovie.com. And also, the National Vaccine Information Center is a really, really good resource run by Barbara Lowe Fisher. It's nvic.org. If you have specific questions, there's really an encyclopedia about vaccines and adverse events there. So I do recommend that.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again, Dr. Hooker. Really appreciate it. Hope you have a great week.
Okay, you too. Thank you so much, Dr. Edwards.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, you've been listening to You're the Cure right here on AM 580, of course, with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Always check out our website as well, veritasmedical.com.